Welcome back into the program. You're the Cure right here on AM 580 with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, with Veritas Medical. Of course, the website, veritasmedical.com. Of course, along the way, phone lines will be open at all times, 745-5800, text line 806-745-5800. Also along for the ride this morning, Melody Wilkes, health coach, right here on the show.
Right.
There it is. And yours truly, I'm Wade Wilkes. Glad to have you in on the broadcast today. Of course, you can always reach us at the clinic at 1-855-6-VERITAS. And again, check out that website, veritasmedical.com. Well, let me say good morning to Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Wade. I'm doing well. How are you this morning?
I'm doing good. I'm back on fasting today, and so I was inspired by last week's program with Dr. Fung, and I did do some fasting for the first 2 or 3 weeks, lost about 5 pounds, and then I went skiing, as you well know, and then I got off, and then I gained the 5 pounds back, and I thought, okay, I'm not going down this road anymore, so I'm just going to, because fasting for me is not that big of a deal. And so after listening to last week's show, I thought, I'm going to fast Mondays and Tuesdays, go back to normal, on Wednesday, maybe even do a 24-hour fast on a Thursday, but then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday be good.
Over what time period did you gain that 5 pounds back?
It took about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
That's so not fair.
It really isn't, right? I mean, it took about two weeks to lose the 5 pounds, or two fasts, to lose the five, and then about 2 weeks of not fasting to gain the five right back. Yeah. So,
well, a lot of my patients that are fat adapted, meaning they've fasted or eaten a higher fat, low carb diet for a while, and their body's used to burning fat for fuel, they'll go on that vacation for a week and eat probably a little more carb or eat more often or both and gain a couple pounds. But right when they're back to their routine, then the pounds come right back down. And that's the beauty of fasting. You can choose not to fast for a time period and then get right back in your routine. And, you know, even the word fasting scares some people. So,
me.
Last week I was starting to use, after Dr. Fung's show, we got a few questions, and I started using the term eating window. Just pick a window of time you want to eat in. You know, like a
4 to 6 hour.
Yeah, 6 hour window, and just pick your 6 hours during the day that you want to eat and eat during that time. And even like Dr. Fung said, you could even eat standard American, and if you're just keeping that to a small window of time, you'll get some of the benefit of the fast. Obviously, the cleaner you eat, the lower glycemic you eat, meaning lower carb you eat, the better, the more benefit you'll get from the fast. So it's
Dr. Anderson talks about on Tuesday show, for a guy like me over the age of 40, he said, really, you shouldn't have more than 20 carbs a day. And I look at that and go, oh, Dr. Anderson, give me what? 20 carbs?
Well, I mean, I agreed.
I'm jumping around in my chair.
Depending on your goals. And, I mean, the people that go to see Dr. Anderson typically are pretty insulin resistant. They've been overweight for a while. They've got metabolic syndrome and have for a long time, meaning blood sugar issues, cholesterol issues, blood pressure issues, overweight issues. So his clientele is going to be, a tougher, metabolically tougher group to turn around. So you do got to get pretty strict if you're wanting to reverse metabolic syndrome and get the weight down. And as you age, you get more stubborn. Your metabolism gets more stubborn. You're more kind of in that habit metabolically, and you're more insulin resistant. You're more toxic. I mean, all this stuff. So, yeah, depend on how quick you're trying to get results and how much you're trying to turn around, the stricter, the better. But also, on the flip side, you meet people where they're at, and if they're not needing to accomplish a lot health-wise in a short period of time, you can go a little slower and have a little more carb, possibly. And I tend to lean towards the side of, guys, this is a long-term, permanent diet and lifestyle transition that you're making. So don't look at it as, you know, normally we look at diets as, hey, I'm going to jump on this diet for X number of weeks or months or until I reach my goal or whatever. And And that mindset's got to change. So that's why, from the psychological standpoint, sometimes I will push people in the deep end with no floaties on the first day. But then other times, depending on the person, I'll just walk them slowly into the shallow end with a life jacket and floaties on. Because you want them to look at this as a permanent way to live life. I mean, we know the number of insulin spikes you have throughout your lifetime. The more you have, the more likely you are to have chronic Western diseases, which is cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, all the diseases that we see are escalating, autoimmune. We see them more with the greater number of insulin spikes throughout your lifetime. So this is a lifetime long-term deal that we're talking about. So I want people to approach it that way and have the right mindset, get educated, and I might not restrict their carbs to 20 on day one. So, I mean, it all depends. There's so many factors and variables. But we know decreasing your insulin spikes is a beneficial thing. So you do that two ways. You don't eat as many carbs because carbs spike insulin, and then you just don't eat, which is the fast we've been talking about. Any amount of eating is going to spike insulin to a degree. So have times in your life where you just don't eat, whether that's a routine time of 16, 17, 18 hours, like every day, just eat in that narrow window of 6 hours. Or every now and then throw in a 24 or 48 once a month, twice a month, whatever. So tons of ways to do it.
I have a question.
I'm doing 40. I just want to say.
Wade?
What? 48. I'm doing 48, okay, once a week. Okay, now go.
Okay. I got to take it, you know, talk when he takes a breath. But you don't do that very often. So I've been doing the fasting. I'm at the point now where last time I had stopped. So I'm like, no, I'm going to push through and do it.
Good. Keep pushing.
I am snacking less, but I am finding that after I eat lunch, in particular, about 30 minutes after I eat lunch, I get really sleepy. And I can eat, like, I'll eat maybe hamburger meat, cheese, and the vegetables, no bun. Or usually every day I eat a salad with meat on it, and I make my own salad dressing with, like, avocado oil. So I'm trying to get all those good fats. But I get so sleepy, I have to go lay down. I can't figure that out.
Do you actually take a nap?
Yes.
Good. How do you feel when you wake up?
Kind of groggy, but it'll make me feel better like later in the evening. Not necessarily an hour afterwards, but later. And if I don't, oh my gosh, I'm like 7 o'clock. I'm like, oh my gosh, keep your eyes open.
Well, my first thought is listen to your body and take a nap. I mean, if your body's saying, I need to sleep, it's trying to get you to rest for some reason. Now, what we would do from the doctor's standpoint is try to figure out, well, why? You're a young, healthy, otherwise healthy lady. You shouldn't have to nap. And let's try to force our way past. Let's try to figure out an answer and give you something to make you not nap. But I'm getting to be more and more hands-off. If the body's telling you to take a nap, because it's trying to heal. Something's going on, whether it's your adrenals are trying to heal or you're flushing toxins out because you're getting into that fat burn mode at that time period in the day, and you're dumping all these toxins, and that's your body needs to rest because when you sleep, you can detoxify more. You know, maybe something like that. It may just be part of your healing is your body's trying to slow you down and rest.
Yeah, and I don't like to slow down.
Let me ask this question to you, though. Prior to breaking the fast, do you always do a burst exercise program? Or
always?
Like,
not always.
Right before, I wonder, but when you do you still feel sleepy after you eat?
Yeah.
Oh, you do, even if you had exercised prior to eating.
I read something like if you do so many squats after you eat lunch. So I'm like in the kitchen doing squats, like, okay, stay awake. I don't want to try anything, you know?
I know. It sounds like you're desperate to stay awake, but I'm going to maybe tell you the opposite. Whatever you're used to doing, which it sounds like you're used to going, and you're used to being able to kind of figure stuff out and fix it, or you want to do that at least, and maybe, you know, God's trying to change that in you. You might just have to let all that go. But now the doctor answer would be, if I'm going to get in there and try to figure it out, it would be interesting to know what your blood sugar and ketones are doing about that, like 30 minutes after you eat. You can get a precision extra glucometer. It has ketone and blood sugar strips. And see if your ketones are up or if they're not, if your sugar's starting to rise or if it's not. And even throughout the day, test that. And that can give us more clues on how insulin resistant you are or not, if you're making ketones or not. So that would be a thought. Another thought would be your adrenals. The adrenals in the afternoon, the adrenal glands make cortisol amongst, 20 other hormones. But that's kind of the main one people think about. And cortisol sort of maintains that blood sugar throughout the day and throughout the afternoon in particular. And if the adrenals aren't putting out quite enough cortisol, you can kind of get that lull or crash. It's possible, but yours is more related to lunch, not necessarily mid-afternoon. The adrenals typically around 2:30, 3 o'clock is when we'll see that. If someone's not making enough cortisol, we'll see that sluggish mid-afternoon thing. Mm-hmm. But it's possible. It's hitting you earlier, so we could check that. But I, knowing you a little more, I would tend to think it's probably more of a toxin issue and the body's just trying to rest. It's part of your healing, I would think. But I also want to talk about the fact you said you're at the same place now that you were you're 3 weeks maybe in.
This is the point where I'd stopped last time.
Right. And you stopped because why?
I don't remember what. I think I just wanted to experiment. Okay, I've done the 3 weeks. I actually that time lost a pound a week, mm-hmm. which I was like, prior to that, the scale wouldn't budge. I don't care what I did.
Yeah.
And so this time, I've only lost a pound.
Okay. Well, the mindset, I think, is what I was talking about earlier. Just understanding this needs to be just a way to eat for the rest of your life. Lower your insulin spikes for the rest of your life. So just stick with it, I think, is what you said Dr. Fung told you off air last week.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. Pomp and Dr. Fung both say, who are kind of my two main go-tos when I have questions on fasting and ketogenesis or ketogenic diet, stick with it. Just keep going. 2 to 3 months it takes some people to really get sensitive with their hormones, which we keep saying this hormone sensitivity. Dr. Fung mentioned it. Just to remind the listeners, that means your receptors are keyed in, tuned up, and cleaned up, and they're able to receive the hormones. So hormones work like a key into a keyhole. If those keyholes are corroded, been out of shape, or in any way inflamed, then they won't be able to see or listen to the hormone.
Well, there's other interesting things that have happened during the fast, and I think snacking is one of them. And I get fuller faster. So in general, I think I'm just eating less.
Mm.
But I still wake up. My stomach's growling right now.
Yeah.
Well,
I would definitely agree with Dr. Fung that I would just give it more time. And there's patients that take those, 2 months to get there. And that probably you're just too early, I would say. But I want to, if the listeners didn't hear last week, we're not talking about necessarily not eating as much, although that's okay if that happens. You can still eat your normal amount of calories. It's more when you eat. It's the time frame that you're eating. So 18 hours of no food going in the mouth, and then 4 hours, 6 hours window of food going in your mouth. That's what we're talking about. Just have time of no eating. So most people, that would be finish dinner at say 7 p.m. then go all night long while you're asleep and skip breakfast and go till lunch the next day. And there's your 18 hours. So it's not really a huge deal. Now, you can fast more than that. You can go 24, 48, 72, longer than that if you want to. The world record, I forgot to ask Dr. Fung, but I read it one day. It was over 300 days. I want to say 350-something days. And that was in a gentleman who was, I think, over 400 pounds. So he had lots of calories stored up in his fat he could use for fuel. And that's ultimately what we're doing during the fast, is we're getting your cells to start to burn fat for fuel. And when this happens, you produce ketone bodies, as opposed to when you burn sugar for fuel and you produce a bunch of free radicals that cause inflammation.
What was that device you said to get to test your ketones?
Precision Extra glucometer. That'll test blood sugar and blood ketone levels.
Where do you get that?
Probably online. And blood sugar, a lot of my patients, they'll want to know, can I drink bulletproof coffee? Can I drink broth? Can I drink regular coffee? Will this interrupt my fast? My general answer is no, but in a few patients it will. So I'll have them get that monitor and check, 30 minutes after their bulletproof coffee, did their blood sugar rise?
That bone broth has 9 grams of protein in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And protein for sure will almost always spike insulin. It's a matter of how much. So, and you don't have to check, but if anyone's struggling, not getting the results, they're not losing weight, or their other symptoms aren't improving, they're still hungry, their energy is down, and they're, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks into it, and they've been doing broth or bulletproof, I would say stop doing that. I would make an educated guess, but you can get this monitor and check.
Well, there's something about, too, that I read on Dr. Fung's literature saying that something about going over 24 hours on a fast, there's something magical that happens.
Yeah.
Okay, to talk about that, because there's what Melody's doing is great. I mean, it's the normal, hey, 18-hour deal, but yeah. The reason I do 48 is because I want to catch that. You know, where it's really firing up. So
well, it's the growth hormone is the biggest thing that I'm aware of, and it starts to go up about that 18-hour mark, and that's why we always shoot for that 18-hour is you see the tick up of the growth hormone. But the further you go, 20, 24, or past that, you get more growth hormone effect up to that 72-hour mark, and it kind of maxes out. But testosterone also will be increased during that when you get past that time frame. But even from a psychological standpoint, you know, pushing through, eventually getting to the point you can go past 18 hours, I think is good.
Well, you start detoxifying beyond 24.
Definitely. You start pushing more toxins out, and sometimes that's good, sometimes it's bad, depending on how toxic you are and how good your detox pathways are. You know, glutathione is your number one antioxidant in the body. You know, it's 1,000 times more powerful than vitamin C as an antioxidant. But some people just run out of it. They use it up too much intracellularly. They get depleted of glutathione. Because you need glutathione to help push these toxins out. So if you get depleted quickly, you could start to feel bad, actually. And that's why we encourage people to do other things. Be sure your bowels are operating fully. Be sure you're very well hydrated so your kidneys are working well. Be sure that you're doing some saunas or some dry brushing or some rebounding, the tiny little trampolines you can have in your room, bounce up and down.
Yeah, I love mine.
Just walking in general, Epsom salt baths. These are ways to help the body push these toxins out of you because you will start to detox more for sure. And, you know, physiologic hunger, where it's more just your habit of eating, always needing something in your hand or something in your mouth, you know, that goes away roughly 48 hours, sometimes 24. So in some patients, we need to push them a little harder to break through some of those old habits and some of the psychology of it and some of the toxicity part. So in people that are having trouble or struggling, there are some nuances that you have to look at. But in general, like what you've done for 3 weeks, just doing 18 hours, that's great. But I'd say probably as you move forward into your next month, you might consider
stretching it
every now and then.
One day I went to 2, and I was like,
48 hours for you.
48
hours.
Till 2 p.m.
Well, just go 20. Then go 22. Then go
24.
Go 24.
Yeah, I just like dinner slowly to dinner. Try to go like an hour longer.
But listen to your body. Everyone's different. I mean, Dr. Fung's super smart. I'm not that smart. I just listen to a lot of smart guys, and I can repeat what they say. But even that, they don't know your body. I mean, everyone's individual and unique. We see these trends in general that are beneficial, but all the little tiny nuances, I get really tired after I eat. Well, that's a guessing game at that point. You know, Dr. Fung, I think, said it might be psychological. I'm saying it could be toxins. But who knows? I mean, it's all educated guessing. So I always lean towards listen to your body. If it's telling you to go take a nap, go take a nap. And probably not for the rest of your life you'll need to do that. But something's going on right now, and we're guessing at what it is making you tired. So I would say give into that and go sleep. And probably the next thing I would do is assist your body with detoxification. So do a couple of saunas a week, do a Myers cocktail, the IVs that help detox, do some rebounding, you know, add something in to help your body.
I don't even
detox
sleep that
better.
Long. Like Wade will sleep 3 hours in his naps. And I
I'm
sleep
really
like
detoxifying.
30 minutes.
Well, a lot of cultures nap in the afternoon, and we in America think, you know, you're weak or something if you can't just plow through and work for 18 straight hours and get up 4 hours at night and keep going the next day and grab your coffee and go. I mean, all this macho kind of work mentality is killing us. So it's okay to take a nap.
Yeah, and I don't take a nap all the time. I mean, I generally, if I'm working in the afternoons, I'll go home and instead of laying down, I'll think, oh, I'm going to go do, you know, a burst training, or I'm going to go lift weights or something. And so I just stay up and do it as opposed to nap. Now, I do tend to enjoy my afternoon nap, but I also know that if I sleep beyond, say, an hour or something, I have trouble at night going back to sleep, mm-hmm. and that's a problem, because mm-hmm. then you're lying awake in bed and the mind won't shut off. Right. And that causes you stress, and I know what stress, we all know what stress does to our body when we're under stress. Mm-hmm. And so it can be counterintuitive if you know, if you're doing it. And again, like you said, everybody's their own chemistry set. They just have to figure out what works best for them, because what works best for me probably not going to work best for her.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. we're really a lot of opposites here.
Right. And, I mean, Dr. Fung, as far as I know, we didn't really get into this on the show last week, but I don't know that he looks a whole lot at toxicity, like heavy metal burden in particular, mm-hmm. But just generalized toxicity. Most toxins are fat-soluble, meaning your body will store them in your fat. You know, if you go and check your serum or your blood level of lead, for instance, it's going to be undetectable or normal, because the body doesn't let the lead just float around in the bloodstream. You're not going to see these heavy metals sitting in your blood because they're toxic. So the body rapidly will store them away in your fat. You know, we check little babies. If you've had a newborn and you've been to your pediatrician, they do a lead level. That's an acute exposure, like your baby's sucking on lead-based paint cribs, you know, or the stuff at the house. Yeah. So if they're getting an acute ongoing exposure, it will show that. But this toxic level that we've, since the Industrial Revolution, study shows we're all burdened with a lot of lead. They tested the bones of cadavers pre-Industrial Revolution until now, and it's like 700 times more lead in the bone today. So we're just under a chronic low-level exposure all the time from our environment. You know, they took the lead out of the paint and the gasoline and other stuff, but it's still in the environment. It's in the dirt, in the air, the water.
That hair analysis that I did, mm-hmm. does that show any toxicities, or is it just minerals?
Yeah, hair tissue mineral analysis will show heavy metals in the hair, but if it's high in the hair, then that means you're exceedingly toxic, because the hair is not a great way to analyze these heavy metals. It seems to be the consensus among all the integrative doctors that I talk with at these conferences. A provoked urine test is the most accurate, meaning you take a chelator, like DMSA is an example. It's a prescription. And a chelator is just something that grabs a heavy metal out of the fat tissue. So you've got to take that and then collect your urine immediately after that for 6 hours. That's more accurate than the hair. So if the hair shows anything, that would tell me that you're way, way, way over the edge of on toxicity. So it's not a great measure for that. We look at the hair more for your mineral status and the pattern in the minerals in the hair, like depending on what level and ratios your sodium to potassium are and your calcium to magnesium and different ratios will give us an idea of how stressed you are. What your adrenals are doing, what your thyroid's doing, cardiovascular risk even.
And that's
lots
another
of good
question
information.
I wanted you to talk about. Like, how do you know the difference between adrenal fatigue and just your thyroid's not working well?
Well, lots of different factors. What we do in our clinic is we look at questionnaires, or we just ask questions. So part of it is the subjective answer of the patient, which I'll go through some of those questions. And then part of it is laboratory analysis, and then part of it is examination findings. For instance, for thyroid, if someone's complaining of inability to lose weight, they feel cold all the time in general, or cold hands, cold feet in particular, constipation, extra dry skin, more than normal, real brittle nails that break real easily, hair falling out more than usual. You know, all those are low thyroid symptoms. And then on exam, if we look at them and we see they have ridges on the edge of their tongue, we call that scallop tongue. That's from a little bit of swelling of the tongue. It pushes against the teeth, and that causes these little indentations. So if they have that, they have a depressed reflexes. If the reflex is real slow, That's a marker of low thyroid. We look, obviously, at the skin to see if it's dry, if the bottom of the feet are real callous. We measure the temperature of the extremities if they're extra cold. Like a lot of our patients, their feet will be 60 degrees, 65, 68, 70. That's very, very common to see that. Even after they take them right out of their shoe and their sock, mm-hmm. they'll still be that cold. So all those are low thyroid symptoms. Myxedema. You can find that on exam. We actually, I wasn't taught that very well in medical school, how to look for that and find that.
What's that?
It's a combination of mucus and water that deposits just underneath your skin. Oftentimes, it's you can find it along your shin bones, your lower leg. We rub up and down the lower leg. As physicians, we rub up and down the leg to feel this kind of lumpy, bumpy feeling. Sometimes it'll be tender, sometimes it won't. Or your upper outer arm. You should be able to pinch skin off the upper outer arm. And a lot of times people think that's all just adipose tissue or fat tissue, but it's actually not. It's a lot of times it's myxedema. Even with when there's fat tissue, you should be able to pull off and pinch some of the skin up off the fat. So the lateral eyebrow thinning, if you look in the mirror and the third outer third, the lateral third of your eyebrows are much thinner than the inner third, that's another clue. None of this is diagnostic. The most diagnostic of everything I just said was the depressed reflexes, the ankle reflex in particular. If it's really slow, that's more diagnostic of low thyroid than anything else, even the blood test. But in general, none of these are totally diagnostic, but if we see two or three physical exam findings, you've got six or seven of those symptoms I just went through, then we're really starting to think you don't have enough T3, that's the active thyroid hormone, inside your cell. Now notice I said T3 and inside your cell, because that's where thyroid does its work. The blood tests we're doing is not looking inside your cell. It tells us what's in your blood. But the question is, does that accurately translate to what's inside your cell?
Yeah, I have so many people tell me, oh, no, I've had my thyroid checked and it's fine.
Yeah, well, it's fine in your blood, and it may be fine inside your cell too. But if you just got through telling me the top 10 symptoms of low thyroid, and then I just examined you and found the top 5 physical exam findings of low thyroid, and then your blood test says you have enough T4, which is your inactive form of thyroid, floating around in your blood, I'm going to question if that blood test is very accurate. And then you go to the scientific literature and find out, well, it's not accurate at all. And then the TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, is another common test. It's probably the number one blood test that doctors look at. And it's not very accurate either as far as intracellular thyroid, determining if inside your cell you have enough T3 active thyroid inside your cell. The TSH blood test isn't that accurate at all. And the ankle reflex study shows more accurate than the TSH. So when you talk about blood work, now, and I will say this, as a busy, conventionally trained medical doctor in post-Texas, when I had to see 40 patients a day, someone would walk in and complain of fatigue and can't lose weight and their hair falling out and they're cold all the time. And the nurse told me, yeah, their temperature is 96. And the patient says, yeah, I always run low. You know, I'd kind of make note of all that. But in that 5 minutes, I didn't have time to do a good exam. I didn't have time to do a more thorough history. And I would just order a TSH. And that's the blood test. It's not super accurate. And then the next day, the TSH would come back normal, and I'd jot a little note on the lab sheet for my nurse to call the patient, let her know her thyroid is normal. She must just be getting old, or she needs to exercise more. You know, I'd just come up with something. And I promise you, if there's doctors listening, conventionally trained medical doctors in a busy primary care setting, family practice setting like I was, 40 patients a day, that's exactly what they do. And that's what we're trained to do. We're not trained to dive deeper and to really get that good history. And that's why I love practicing the way we practice now, because we spend an hour with every patient. We can really dive deeper. So that's thyroid. Now, and what do you do about that? Well, there's a number of things to do about it. You know, when I said your T4, the inactive form of thyroid, can be normal in your bloodstream, but it's got to be taken into the cell and it's got to be converted to T3. So the problem may be you just have two or three or five things going on that's blocking the uptake of your T4 into your cell, or blocking the conversion of T4, the inactive form, into T3, the active form. So we look for things that block that, like birth control pills will block that, low iodine will block that, low B vitamin, B12 in particular will block that, low selenium will block that. Increase insulin spikes, going back to the fasting. When you're eating all day or multiple times a day, and especially processed grains and sugars or any kind of carb, you spike insulin. Insulin spikes block your T4 to T3 conversion. Stress, which causes cortisol to rise, your adrenal gland hormone, stress hormone I call it, that will block your T4 to T3 conversion. So there's a whole host of things. Low iron. A lady's anemic, she has heavy cycles all the time, low iron, that'll block your conversion. So kind of the easy button answer is just take some T3. Get an Armour thyroid or Nature thyroid or one of these desiccated thyroids and take T3. But better than that would be work on the things that are blocking your normal conversion.
Let's go to the phones. Good morning. Welcome into the show.
Yeah, I have one question for the doctor. How long can you safely take amiodarone?
Oh, that's a kind of a tough question. It's designed to be taken for a long, long, long time, like a lifetime, the rest of your days. Amiodarone's normally used as by cardiologists to try to keep the heart in the right rhythm or to prevent it from going to irregular rhythm. So typically when it's prescribed, it's designed to be forever. Now, so a doctor's going to say, well, it's safe enough, and I would agree. In certain circumstances, you got to look at the risk and benefit. I mean, any chemical you put in your body that's not normally found there could potentially cause some harm. Amiodarone's the same. So there's definitely risk involved, but then you got to look at the other side. Okay, if I don't take this, what are my risk? And if your risk is... if your risk is an irregular heart rhythm that's going to cause a heart attack and death, then you kind of got to take, you know, choose the lesser of two evils, so to speak.
Okay, now let me ask you this question about amiodarone versus Beltag. Is there a difference?
You mean from a risk standpoint?
Well, I know they're one for price, but yeah, from the risk, is it safer for Beltag or is it safer going the other way?
I don't know that I can really make a judgment call which one's safer, and it depends on your individual circumstances, you know, how good your liver function, your kidney function, how other medications that you're on. Amiodarone can have lots of drug interactions, so it's not kind of a one size fits all kind of answer.
Okay, well, I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You bet. Yeah, I have people ask me all the time about this medicine or that medicine, and can I just stop it? And with everything, you've got to look at risk and benefit. Why are you taking it? What's the root cause of the problem that caused you to have to take that medicine? Can you fix that problem? And in conventional medicine, that's what we're not good at, fixing arrhythmias. Those are things you have to look at.
So, see, I'm on Synthroid. I want to get off one day. I don't want to always have to be on Synthroid. And the Armour's, at the time I took it anyway, I don't know about today, but it didn't work.
Well, for me. We find that certain people do well on Armour, others don't. Certain people do better on Naturethroid, others don't. Certain people do well on Westheroid or NP thyroid. These are different versions of desiccated natural thyroid, meaning it has both T4 and T3. And then a few people will do well on Synthroid, which is synthetic T4. But if you are on just T4, you really want to be sure you're avoiding all those things I just mentioned that block the conversion of T4 to T3. So low iron, low selenium, low iodine, low B12, insulin spikes, all those kind of things.
So I take that pH balancer.
Mercury can block the T4, the receptors for T3.
I'm just going to go pull all my teeth.
Well, amalgam fillings have a lot of mercury, and the mercury does leach out. That's what the studies show. The dentists are trained in dental school that it's stable, that it doesn't leach out, but we now know it does. So that's definitely something we look at in our patients. Mm-hmm. I mean, mercury is just, it's deadly. It all by itself can cause a ton of symptoms, but one of the things it'll do is block the thyroid receptor. So that's thyroid. I don't know if we need to take a break and then we can talk about adrenal maybe.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
We'll do that and we'll come right back again. Phone lines are open 745-5800. Right back with more. Welcome back to You're the Cure right here on AM 580 with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, Veritas Medical. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com. You can also listen to the shows. We upload them there. At veritasmedical.com, all one word, number to the clinic, 1-855-6-VERITAS. And, of course, along the way, if you have any questions for the good doctor, 745-5800, 745-5800. You can text in that question as well at 806-745-5800. Okay, so right back at it, we're talking about adrenal failure, right?
Well, there's lots of different words for it. I mean, in med school, that's what we learn is we don't learn much about the adrenals except if they just totally poop out. And that's when you get, I mean, you're in the hospital when you're that bad. But leading up to that, and that's kind of just, I hate to say, now looking back, I see it this way. That conventional medicine kind of, we sit around till the bomb explodes, until the adrenals mm-hmm. are totally crashed and you're in the hospital, or you're just so sick it's blatantly obvious. But we're not really good in those first stages of dysfunction. And that's where most people are when they're going to the doctor. They're just not feeling bad, and they have brain fog and they're fatigued and they just can't lose weight. And these kind of more generic symptoms that there's not really a pill to fix. So we just kind of kick the can down the road until something's totally disrupted, like the adrenals are totally crashed. So in med school, I didn't learn anything about what we call or about to call adrenal fatigue or adrenal insufficiency. That really wasn't really a topic. Of course, it's a huge topic in the integrative functional medicine realm because everybody's walking around in this state. So, and a lot of the symptoms can sort of overlap with thyroid, but you can tease out the difference, and oftentimes both are going on. The adrenals and thyroid kind of play off each other a little bit, so oftentimes you'll see both. But for adrenals, definitely fatigue will be there, like in low thyroid, but this can be more of like just so much fatigue, like a weakness, even like a muscle weakness, just you just can't even get out of bed in the morning kind of fatigue. And it tends to be that morning, really having trouble getting up and getting going in the morning. And then if there's an afternoon crash, that 2:30, 3 o'clock that we mentioned earlier, if you really start to crash there, because normally the adrenals will make cortisol hormone, a little bit of it in the morning, you'll get this little bump to kind of get you revved up and going for your day. And then the production of cortisol kind of slows down throughout the rest of your mid-morning, midday, but then around 3 in the afternoon you get another little spike of cortisol production and kind of get you through the rest of your day. And then cortisol will also, your adrenals will make a little cortisol throughout the night while you're asleep to maintain a normal blood sugar level. So if someone's waking up a lot throughout the night, that's a minor clue. Could be the adrenals. Another big clue that I see is people cannot handle any amount of stress. You get a tiny little disruption of your normal pattern of your day. I mean, even a minor thing like, I don't know, a leaky faucet. For some people, I guess that's major. But these little, what should be little tiny stressors in the day that you should be able to just handle, no problem, you can't. Every little thing sets you off, and you're just snappy, and you jump at everybody. So decreased ability to handle stress. Poor memory is very common with adrenal insufficiency. Just some people call it brain fog, but just they can't find their keys more than usual. They can't remember people's names more than usual. Just memory issues in general. We'll see a suppressed immune system. People just say, man, every little bug, I catch everything my kids bring home, or every time I'm in Sunday school at church with in the nursery, I'm always getting sick. Like every month I'm sick. So we'll see a decreased or suppressed immune function with adrenal fatigue. Allergies, hives, and just allergies in general, skin problems like eczema, you know, low thyroid will be just generalized dry skin throughout, but it'll be more severe, like all the way to a hives type of thing. And again, these aren't diagnostic, but if you start stacking a lot of these up, you start to wonder. Just autoimmune disease in general, you'll be more prone to autoimmune stuff when the adrenals are kind of stressed. But it's that early morning and mid-afternoon, that's the big one, and inability to handle stress. Also cravings, salt cravings, foods high in salt, but it could be high in sugar too, because you can't maintain your own blood sugar, you're always crashing, so you kind of crave that. That could be a sign of adrenals. And then just general hormone symptoms across the board that we may think of thyroid and testosterone or estrogen and progesterone symptoms. If someone has all those, I think a cortisol. Because if you think about these hormones, where are they all made from? Cholesterol. Cholesterol is the precursor or the main ingredient that makes where you get all these hormones from. So if you're asking your adrenal gland to make more cortisol all the time because you're stressed out all the time, that's what'll demand more cortisol production is stress, fight or flight mode. Then you shift all the cholesterol production, not all of it, but a substantial amount of it over to cortisol pathway. So you're robbing the other ones, progesterone, testosterone, estrogen. You're robbing those. So people that have just low hormones across the board, we think of adrenals being out of whack. Now, when I say out of whack, basically it's a protective mechanism. The adrenal glands are only doing what the brain tells it to do. So the adrenal glands are two tiny little glands that sit on top of your kidney, and they secrete various hormones that help regulate your minerals and also the fight or flight hormone cortisol. And so we're not designed to be in fight or flight very much. It should be a rare occasion where we get sympathetic dominant, meaning the nerves that are your fight or flight nerves turn on, tell your adrenals to pump out cortisol. That should be rare. But when you're like that too often, too much, then you're pumping cortisol out all the time. Well, that cortisol, constant cortisol hitting your brain through the bloodstream, your brain's being exposed, the neurons in your brain are being exposed to this cortisol all the time. It actually damages neurons in the brain. It's partly what causes the memory issues. So the brain says, after a while, the brain will say, man, I can't take this anymore. And it'll send signals to your adrenals to shut down, quit making so much cortisol, and then they'll shut them almost all the way down as a protective mechanism to protect your brain. So when we measure your cortisol levels and we see they're in the tank, it's not that your adrenal glands are dead or damaged or whatever. It's they're responding to the signal from the brain to stop making cortisol. And the brain's only saying that because it's sick and tired of seeing too much cortisol and it's getting damaged by too much cortisol. So the adrenals are really just responding to the brain's signal. But the brain's signaling that because you've been in a high cortisol state for so long. So a lot of doctors will look at this as stage 1, 2, and 3 adrenal fatigue. Where stage 1 being that initial stage where you're in fight or flight all the time, so your cortisol is actually high all the time. If you test your levels, they'll be high. That's stage 1. Stage 2 is when the brain starts to tell the adrenals to shut off. So you'll be coming back down on your cortisol level, and you can actually kind of catch it in the normal range. But they have all the symptoms, but then they're in the normal range. Well, that's just because you can happen to catch them right when they're coming back down. And then stage 3 would be when the adrenals are totally turned off and you're super low across the board. You should have the little spike in the morning, little spike in the afternoon, and you're just flatlined. So you can try to test this with blood, with the serum or blood test. It's not super accurate again, kind of like the thyroid. A first morning cortisol is probably the most accurate, very first thing in the morning, right when you wake up, go to the lab, get it drawn. But most people, they get up, they get going, they get dressed, they drive to the lab, and a needle's about to be jabbed in your arm. I mean, all that's a little bit stressful, and, and so you get this maybe artificial little bump in cortisol, so it may not be super accurate. So we like to use saliva or urine, and I think urine's more accurate. And we get multiple samplings throughout the day. So the first thing in the morning, you know, mid-morning, mid-afternoon, later in the evening, and we can get a real good picture that way by doing a spot urine test throughout the day. And you can assess the different levels and make some estimations. But again, that's just a piece of it. The blood or the saliva or the urine is a piece of it. You look at all the symptoms and you look at the patient and you have to put it all together. So it's not this simple little, you know, check a blood test, you're low, take a pill to fix it. It's not that at all. Adrenals are very, very, very tricky to fix. You know, they're not broken. Like I said, they're just responding to the brain, telling it to shut down. What you really have to fix is what got you here in the first place is this sympathetic dominance, which is the fight or flight dominance. So you got to look at your life and see what is causing fight or flight all the time. And usually that's a lot of things, and usually they're things that are hard to fix. They are rooted in lifestyle, rooted in relationships, rooted in work stuff, rooted in finances, rooted in thoughts and beliefs we have about ourselves that could be from way back when you were a kid or even generationally. It can be rooted in the news, if you know, watching the news and things that you feel like you have no control over and they're stressing you out. So, I mean, it's just life. So how do you just fix life? Well, that's a whole different show's topic that we'll get into someday. Yeah. But ultimately, that's what you want to do. Now, you can take some herbs. They're called adaptogens. And ashwagandha is one. Licorice is another. There's four or five different. Yeah. Rhodiola. What these herbs do is basically blunt the effect of the cortisol on your brain. So that damaged neuron that you're getting because of all the cortisol hitting your brain, it'll kind of shield or protect your neurons. So it's not really fixing the problem. It's just kind of protecting the brain, so then the brain won't tell your adrenals to shut off as much, and you'll still have some cortisol production.
And caffeine's really hard on your adrenals.
Caffeine definitely can be hard on the adrenals, especially if you've got 10 other things going on. Caffeine added to the mix, especially too much caffeine, which adrenal fatigue patients tend to do because they have no energy, so they're on the caffeine all day long. That's a stressor that causes even more adrenal burnout. A little bit of caffeine in the morning in a healthy patient that's not real stressed, no problem. But 3, 4, or 5 cups all throughout the day in someone who is stressed, it is a problem. So in most of our patients with adrenal symptoms like we've listed, then we have to pull the caffeine back. We've got to put the herbs in them to protect them a little bit. And sometimes we'll give them a little extra precursor of hormones like DHEA and pregnenolone. These are hormones that help stimulate your other hormone pathways, the testosterone, progesterone pathways that are being robbed. So we'll try to support your other hormones. We'll look at your thyroid and support that. We'll try to bring inflammation down. Gut inflammation is a big stressor on the adrenals. Insulin spikes all day long. That's a big stressor on the adrenal. So, I mean, all the things we preach for every problem people mm-hmm. walk in the door with, we have to do with adrenals also. It's just a lot trickier because these patients tend to be, their adrenals tend to have been taxed for a very long time. And so it takes a long time to get them back.
Are you seeing more kids with this? Because I just see kids' stress levels going way up.
Yeah, we're seeing more kids with everything. Hypothyroid, adrenal symptoms, obesity, type 2 diabetes, you name it, autoimmune for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, 43% of our kids today have a chronic disease that used to be adult diseases. Now half our kids have them. So yeah, and adrenals are one of those things. So these are tough issues, no doubt about it. And I want to throw out there too, marathon runners or just extreme exercise in general, but it tends to be the marathon runners end up at our clinic. And that's a stressor. In my humble opinion, the body's not designed to be in this intense, extreme exercise mode a lot, which marathon runners tend to be in a lot. But they love it, and the endorphins, and it makes them, they're almost addicted to it. But, man, it'll burn the adrenals. And trying to get those guys to pull back on their training or their marathon, unless they've totally crashed and they can't get out of bed and they're forced to stop, I mean, these guys just won't stop. They'll cut it down to just 10 miles a week or 5 miles a week or 3 miles a week or whatever. And we have to get them to just go on a leisurely stroll 3 times a week and call it good. And that's tough. Mm-hmm. So there are so many. I mean, adrenal is probably one of the toughest things to go after. Because these people just don't feel good. And they have to have that caffeine or whatever to make themselves try to get through the day. So it's tough. Adrenal insufficiency, I forget the author of that book, but just look on Amazon. It's a good book that kind of explains all this, just called Adrenal Insufficiency. Or Dr. McCullough has some good articles too. But I'm going to tell you my experience. It's going to boil down to those four pillars: nutrition, mm-hmm. hydration, movement, and peace.
But isn't it conventional medicine, though, as adrenals have, as you just outlined, all these issues, it leads into other issues, anxiety, depression, all these. So the first thing that conventional doctors do is say,
antidepressant.
Here's some Klonopin. Here's
especially
Paxil.
A woman.
Yeah. Here's, you know, some.
They can't sleep at night. They get Ambien.
It just goes on and on and on.
Depressed, so they get some Zoloft. They're, just all these symptoms you have to start chasing. We don't have a good pill for energy or for memory loss. So those two, you kind of just, we kick those to the curb as far as doctors go. If you don't have a pharmaceutical that can fix it, then you don't have anything in your toolbox to use. So the things we can go after, insomnia, depression, mood stuff in general, we'll do that. But you're just treating a symptom.
And it's really the adrenals, that's the foundation of that, mm-hmm. that's causing panic attacks, anxiety, depression. There's like, is that right?
Yeah.
Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah,
the adrenal
for sure.
glands are really where all that originates from and having problems.
It can. It sure can, especially if you line up a lot of these symptoms. If I ticked off all those symptoms, you start to see those, and people have anxiety, then yeah, for sure, that can be the cause of it.
I have a friend who's got a 15-year-old daughter that's on anti-anxiety meds.
Yeah, I mean, it's rampant. I mean, medication use in general, but the psychotropic medications for sure, meaning the different mood stabilizers or different drugs designed to help with mood. Rampant, even in young people.
Yeah, that's really sad because it's like you're masking the problem. Yeah, you'll feel better. Serotonin levels go up.
Yeah.
But then again, a lot of people get on these, and after a while, they end up, you know, almost
going
psychotic.
But you know what's
psychotic.
Frustrating is that's mm-hmm. what people want. They go on the doctor, they have anxiety,
they
sleep.
Right?
I want a pill.
No,
fix, we all want that. I mean, none of us have time to be sick. We all got our stuff we got to go do. We've got our vacations or our work, or we got to make our money or keep our family running or whatever. We've got life responsibilities. The last thing anyone has time for is to go to the doctor and deal with symptoms. And so we don't. We ignore them until they're so bad we finally go. But even then, we want the quick fix because we don't have time to think about this and deal with this. It's just the culture that we're in. The funny thing is, it's this go, go, go mentality that's gotten us to this place to begin with. And even the studies show 90 to 95% of cancer is diet and lifestyle related. And that's just what we're talking about here. Adrenal insufficiency is a lifestyle issue. Diet, which is a high glycemic insulin spike kind of diet, is a stressor. So these things all boil down to the simple stuff your great-grandparents could have told you. But we don't have time to do that. We're too busy living our life, our American dream. And
well,
so
good health is a journey more so than a destination.
It really is, because you're getting educated, you're renewing your mind, you're going against the culture. You're going against conventional medicine and American society and our fast-paced life and our grab-and-go food and all this stuff. So to go against the norm, yeah, I mean, it's a full-time rest of your life kind of thing. It has nothing to do with a quick fix and give me a pill.
Yeah.
So it's just a totally different way to practice medicine, but it's a totally different way to be a patient also. And you really have to be involved as a patient. You have to be educated. You have to be committed, because it's you that has to do all these changes. That's the name of the show that we're doing today. You're the cure, because it's true. You are the cure.
What a great time.
You can do this. I mean, the doctor at best can treat the symptom. And that's what all our studies show. Now, after 60 or 70 years of treating symptoms with pills, we're at a place where we're spending more money than everyone else and we're bankrupt. We get the worst health outcomes. We have the most diseases, and we die younger than any other country. And we're taking the most drugs and going to the doctor the most, spending the most money. So, I mean, it's the experiment of 70 years has proven it doesn't work. So patients need to understand that. I can choose to treat symptoms with a pill, but I'm at risk for early death and all these complications and symptoms all along the way. Or I can look at the root cause and work on it myself, because my doctor can't do it for me.
Dr. Ben Edwards, everybody, again, check out veritasmedical.com. And Dr. Edwards, it's always a pleasure. We look forward to seeing you back here next week on the show. And we'll do that. Again, stick around. Unconfused coming up next. But check out the website, veritasmedical.com. Dr. Edwards, you have a wonderful week. We'll look forward to seeing you back here real soon.
Thank you, Wade. Thanks, Melody.
Thanks.